Welcome to the London Business School podcast channel. Today's podcast is hosted by Peter Hinson, Chairman of NextWorks. Peter also teaches on the Exploiting Disruption in a Digital World programme. This podcast examines what comes after the advancement of digital. Peter is joined by Greg Sattell, a best-selling author, speaker, and innovation advisor. His book, Mapping Innovation, A Playbook for Navigating a Disruptive Age, was chosen as one of the best business books of 2017 by 800 CEO Read. Greg has 15 years of experience building and managing media businesses in Eastern Europe. Greg shares his expertise on media, marketing, and technology on his blog, Digital Tonto.
Welcome to our podcast. And today we have Greg Sattell on the podcast. Greg, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Greg, I absolutely love Digital Tonto, which is your blog, but you have had an amazing journey. You've been an executive, an entrepreneur, you're a writer, you're a speaker. I really loved your latest book, Mapping Innovation, A Playbook for Navigating a Disruptive Age. Tell me, Greg, if you look at what is happening in the world at large, and you know, disruption is really the absolute top word of the time, are people getting a little bit tired of disruption? Are people now getting the fact that they really, really have to change faster?
It's a good question. I guess it would depend on the person. I think that the biggest disruption going on now is the end of the digital revolution. And I think what's interesting about that kind of disruption is it's the type of disruption that disrupts the disruptors, right? Because for the past 20 or 30 years, we've had this very nice thing that we call Moore's Law. And it sort of delivered, like Santa Claus, you know, a doubling of the power of our technology every 18 months or so, you know, and that's been going on for 50 years. And that meant that every, you know, 18 months, 2 years, whatever it was, we had new possibilities. And it was like innovation for free because every new generation of chips worked exactly like the last generation of chips. It was just better and faster and more efficient and all good things.
And cheaper.
Cheaper and just better in almost every way. So we have to figure out what comes after digital, right? And that won't go so smoothly.
So when you talk about the end of digital, is it, for example, artificial intelligence, which is taking on a whole new role? I mean, is it the end of digital and the beginning of the cognitive age? What kind of ingredients do you see for that beyond digital?
First of all, just to clarify, it's not going to be the end of digital technology. It's the end of the advancement of digital technology, which is a little bit of a different thing. So if you're running a large organization, you most likely do have an enormous amount of digital transformation still to do. You need to move things to the cloud. You need to adopt, probably over the next 5 years, blockchain for your supply chain. So there's still lots of that implementational work to be done. However, in terms of the fundamental advancement for the underlying technology, that's either over or almost over, depending on how you define over and who you're talking to. So the first thing we're going to have to do is figure out new ways how to compute things. And there are some very advanced efforts in quantum computing and neuromorphic computing, but those technologies work fundamentally differently than digital technologies. We need new computing languages, we need new logic, we need new infrastructure, and we need to learn how we use these technologies of quantum and neuromorphic. There's also emerging technologies. The most advanced, of course, is artificial intelligence, which is really starting to gain traction. But again, artificial intelligence is not inherently a digital technology. I think you could argue that it's inherently an analog technology. and will probably advance much faster when we are able to compute it in a more analog way than we are now, because we lose some information transferring analog information into digital. And that's one of the things that's holding artificial intelligence and machine learning back a little bit. Mm-hmm. Another is genomics, which is moving incredibly fast, much faster than Moore's Law ever did, and sort of went on steroids ever since Jennifer Doudna discovered CRISPR in 2012. I don't remember anything that spread as fast as CRISPR. I mean, that is really incredible. It's just transformed the field in 6 years. And the last, which in some ways is moving the fastest, is material science. So think about any of the major challenges we face over the next 10 or 20 years, things like, you know, clean energy and storage and how we're going to manufacture things in a sustainable way, supply chain bottlenecks. All of these things depend on our ability to create new and advanced materials. And our ability to do that over the last 10 years has just gone through an absolute paradigm shift and is just beginning to accelerate now. So those are all very, very new things that we don't understand very well at all. So I think that over the next 10 or 20 years, we're going to have to shift from this idea of disruption to pursuing grand challenges and giving ourselves a longer runway in order to be able to develop technologies that are going to have an impact in 5 or 10 years down the road.
Well, I really like that framework, Greg. So let's do a little bit of a deeper dive on these three. And let me start with the second one that you mentioned. Everything that happens in genomics, I mean, we're recording this at the end of 2018, where we had the first two CRISPR twin babies born that were genetically modified to be able to be more resistant for HIV. It's something that took the world by surprise. And as you said, it's something that appeared only as science a few years ago, and now it seems to be completely transforming how we think about healthcare. Is the healthcare system as we know it prepared to deal with such massive transformational changes? Because in my experience, and I'd love your input, healthcare has been one of the slowest moving parts of society. So how are they going to cope with such a monumental, massive, and especially really fast change?
Well, I think, you know, in some ways, healthcare has moved very fast on the science side. I mean, if you look what's gone on in cancer science over the last 10 or 20 years, it's moved extremely fast. If you look at something like cancer immunotherapy, and I interviewed Jim Allison for my book, who just won the Nobel Prize for cancer immunotherapy. I mean, something that really didn't exist 10 years ago and now is taking the world by storm. From an administrative capacity, healthcare is obviously very bureaucratic, very slow to adopt digital technologies, and very organizationally cumbersome. But I think you're hitting on something on a deeper level, and that is the conflict between ethics and technology, which has always been somewhat of an issue. Mm-hmm. But I was at a cognitive colloquium at IBM just a couple of years ago, and all of a sudden it hit the entire AI community like a storm that nobody had really thought through the ethics of artificial intelligence. Some of the things have been talked about, things like the trolley problem, and if your self-driving car needs to kill the passenger or five pedestrians, what should it do? Those were always sort of cocktail party type of discussions, and now they're becoming things that we actually have to code into our technology, have to actually make decisions about that. There's other issues that are more subtle. For instance, every parent knows the feeling of concern about the influences their kids are being exposed to. Mm-hmm. Who's teaching our kids? Who are they hanging around with, right? Well, who's teaching our algorithm? How are those algorithms making decisions? And we have a massive problem with bias, well, data bias in general, but bias in the learning set. So how is our AI going to learn? And that's becoming extremely important as we're handing over decision-making to algorithms for things as varied as whether we get into the school we want to, whether we get a job, whether we go to prison, whether we get paroled. And then that raises questions about, well, who's responsible for the decision that an algorithm makes? Mm-hmm. And how much transparency should we have? And should the responsibility for an algorithmic decision be the same, less, or greater than for a human decision? Mm-hmm. These are all things that we've just really started just thinking about maybe 2 years ago in a serious way when they set up the Partnership for AI.
Yeah, so, and I think you're right. I mean, I think the ethical and moral almost dilemmas that we're going to face in a world with more and more evolution and disruption is mind-blowing. And you're right. CRISPR is maybe just the beginning. AI is just around the corner. And what fascinates me is spending a lot of time with people, say, in the AI field, is that, as you said, we've known about it for a long time, but it was so exciting to be part of the real, you know, transformational work being done in AI that a lot of these ethical and moral discussions are almost became a side activity. And it's now taking more center stage, I think.
Just to give an analogy, back in the 1960s, when mathematical finance was first getting started, a mathematician by the name of Benoit Mandelbrot started raising alarms that these algorithms that we're using to calculate risk are far undercounting the risk in the models. And he wasn't really listened to until 2008, and they said, oops, I guess he was right. And it's similar with AI, it's similar with CRISPR. The genetic engineering of babies is just one aspect of the CRISPR moral universe. Obviously, the medical and the agricultural impacts of genomics are front and center, but we're going to be using genomics for a lot of other things, such as how to build materials, how to, you know, we have a lot of materials, for instance, plastics that are derived from petroleum. If we want to go carbon free, we need to find a different way of doing them. So, if we can, for instance, grow plastic in bacteria or yeast, that might be a much, much more sustainable way of doing things. But then again, we worry today about teenagers sitting in coffee shops and dreaming up computer viruses. You know, in a decade, we're going to have to worry about the same thing, but with real viruses, with biological viruses. How are we prepared? How's that controlled? How's it regulated? Who's responsible?
And you've had a very international career. You've been in Eastern Europe. You've worked in, I think, in Russia and in Ukraine and Poland and Turkey. To that point, what you're talking about, some of these regulations, is it a surprise that what we have now in terms of the CRISPR experiments, that comes, for example, out of China? Do you think that we're going to see a lot of those breakthrough innovations, not just on the scientific side, but also on how we think about this from a cultural point of view or almost a societal point of view? Do we think that we're going to see that coming from, say, Asia or, you know, different geographies?
Or sub-Saharan Africa? Mm-hmm. I mean, believe me, China's the worst of our problems. China has a lot to lose, you know. CRISPR technology is incredibly easy to use. And it's not just the technology itself, it's the ecosystem, right? So there is an entire, much like we have a technology stack and digital technology, right? I mean, most coders don't really write code that much. They take it from banks, they take it from libraries here or there. They take the software from GitHub or wherever it is. They can take the hardware from all sorts of different places. You can get algorithms from IBM, Amazon, Microsoft. There, you know, you can just use their AI algorithms or tools, or and everybody's rushing to give it to you. The same thing is developing in CRISPR, where you're getting CRISPR tools, you're getting platforms, you can order up nucleotide bases, you can order specific CRISPR sequences. So that's all coming. So in much the same way, I mean, today, any reasonably talented high school student could throw together a website. In 5-10 years, any reasonably talented high school student could make a virus.
Yeah, and you know, I spend a lot of time in the innovation hubs, whether it's China or Europe or the US, and I've been fascinated by what happens. And as you said, you're seeing a complete analogy between what happened in computer science in the 1980s and 90s and the rise of tools and platforms. And now that is happening in bio and in this whole genetic environment. It's fascinating to see people talk about genetic compilers.
Absolutely. I think we should, you know, get some perspective on the danger, though, because if you could go back to 1940 and someone would tell you, we have this technology that we can develop and it can destroy the world with these massive bombs, but it's going to help us cure cancer. Would you really choose not to develop nuclear technology? Nuclear technology has solved far more problems than it's caused. I think the same is true with digital technology and CRISPR, and will be with materials as well.
So taking that all into account, Greg, I mean, new ways to compute, quantum computing is fascinating to see the advances, the mechanisms of using logic into the network, which is blockchain, and the possibilities there, genomics, material science, all those things probably mean that digital disruption was really just a warm-up game, right? I mean, it seems to be like massive changes that companies have to prepare for.
So if you go back, here's a good way to think about it. Think about entering a typical household back in 1950. If you walked into that household, everything would seem old and quite inefficient and, you know, slow and not nearly as good as the technology we have today. But you could enter that household and you could fully function. I mean, they had TVs, they had refrigerators, air conditioners, roads, cars, most of the stuff we have today. Okay, they didn't have video games and mobile phones, but they had regular phones and you'd get on fine. But if you had to go back to the typical household in 1900, you would struggle to survive. Even something as basic as cooking a meal or washing yourself, you would have to haul water, firewood, wait for the fire to get hot enough. It would take you hours to cook a regular meal. And that's because the previous general purpose technologies of electricity and internal combustion, they were rooted in the physical world, in the world of atoms, and they changed everything. And it powered a productivity boom that, at least in the United States, lasted from 1920 to 1970. These technologies powered a boom that lasted from the end of the 90s to maybe midway through the aughts. So the technologies we're talking about now are likely to be far more impactful than digital ever was.
So if you take that into account, and I'm curious to hear your point of view. I mean, you've spent a lot of time with large corporations, seeing how they trying to deal with innovation or disruption. And I'm a fan of your work and I'm constantly studying that field as well. It's fascinating to see that on the one hand, we have a fascination with the new companies, you know, the Amazons of this world and the Facebooks and the Googles. But of course, those companies are maturing as well with all the complexities. On the other hand, you have the older companies trying to reinvent themselves. And we're always cheering for those companies that can reinvent themselves, but sometimes it just doesn't work. Look at recently with GE, who was almost the champion of the industrial disruption, and then GE is having a really rough time. How do you see that playing out? Can we take some lessons from that first digital element of disruption and say, okay, these are clearly the lessons that corporates have to learn before they tackle the really next big wave?
Well, I think we need to ask, the first is the common question. Why is IBM as successful as Google? right? Mm-hmm. And that's the obvious question, right? But the other question we need to ask is, will Google be as successful as IBM in 100 years? That's much less clear. IBM is actually one of the companies that impresses me the most. While it's true that they basically, their business seems to blow up every 20 years, that is certainly not a good thing. They're also able to reinvent themselves every 20 years or so. I mean, if you look just recently where their core business of installed solutions has been completely decimated, where at the same time, they're on the cutting edge of things like quantum computing and blockchain and lots of other things. And the reason is because they always start early. They've been developing quantum computing technology for 30 years. Mm-hmm. GE, on the other hand, decided that they were going to become a strategic company and optimize everything they do. And they stopped inventing. GE hasn't invented anything since CT scanners back, I think it was in the 70s. And I think Jack Welch actually has a lot of blame for the way GE is today, because if you don't explore, you don't discover. If you don't discover, you don't invent. If you don't invent, you're going to be disrupted eventually. So I think the key is really to start early and to have a sustainable program of exploration. And the real benefit of that is that exploration is pretty cheap. Product development is expensive. And we've seen this with IBM as well, when they had to develop the IBM 360 because they got their legendary line of servers because they got behind in digital technology. It cost them in today's dollars something like 30 or 40 billion, which is just a ridiculous amount of money, you know, 5 billion back in 1960s dollars. But then you look at something like Watson, which I think cost them 10 or 20 million dollars to develop. It really wasn't that expensive. They've spent a lot more money since then developing the business, but the basic exploration doesn't really cost much of it is in the public domain. If you look at what Google does, Google has a very interesting program where they invite the world's greatest scholars and experts in every computer-related field you can imagine, from mathematicians and computer scientists and artificial intelligence experts. They invite them to spend a semester or a full academic year at Google, and they're paid just like a regular employee. And that's really driven Google's ability to stay on top. Now, that is not a real expense. I mean, that's not a material expense in a company with the scale of Google. If you look at how a small and medium-sized enterprise would use the same strategy, every business has some local university, you know, within an hour's drive. You know, postdocs aren't making any money. I mean, people don't go into academics to become millionaires. You can engage with those people at a very, very low cost, low effort, often just payment in kind. And they love to be exposed to real world problems as well. We also have in America, and I'm sure in Europe as well, we have new structures that are forming, these sort of massive collaborative structures. One of them is the manufacturing institutes around things like composite materials, advanced fabrics, 3D printing. Some are around specific technologies like advanced batteries. They're just everywhere. All of them have some type of major corporate sponsorship, but they also have associate memberships where small and medium-sized companies can go and engage and attend conferences and also help shape the technologies for, you know, something like at the manufacturing institutes, anywhere from $0 to $15,000 a year, depending on the particular institute and the size of the company. So we're really not talking about a material cost. Another trend I'm seeing is spinning in rather than just spinning out. So the national labs are inviting entrepreneurs to come spend 2 years to develop their technologies. Lots of corporations are starting incubators so that they can get exposed to things that entrepreneurs are working on and find new partners and new suppliers. So there's all sorts of ways that you can see the future at very, very low cost.
And I like your idea of using the network to do that. I think you're right. I mean, whether it's, you know, reaching out to institutions or, you know, academia, I think this is a much more networked world. Even your example of IBM, I mean, they don't do everything themselves. Recently, IBM buying Red Hat for, you know, $33 billion is a massive reach out. And then investing in a business model that is open source, which is completely outside of their comfort zone, is a really good indication of their willingness to take some really big risks.
Well, they actually started investing in open source back in 95. Mm-hmm. They actually started donating patents to the Linux Foundation somewhere there in the 90s, you know, hundreds of patents to protect it. Microsoft saw Linux as a threat, where IBM saw it as their ticket back to the game, right? And also a way to save a lot of money, because that was a lot of development that they didn't have to invest in.
Maybe a final question for you, Greg. I like it when you said in the beginning that when we talked about disruption, you mentioned the concept grand challenges. I really like that. It's disruption seems like almost like a bad word where you have to be scared, but if you turn it around and you talk about grand challenges, that is a very positive way of looking at it. But at the same time, you said, maybe we need a longer runway. Do you think that today, in that first digital wave of disruption, that we became blindsided by the short-term returns and that we need a longer take on innovation?
Well, I think that with respect to digital technology, in very much the same way as internal combustion and electricity, we've understood the fundamental technologies really, really well. So over the last 20 or 30 years, much of the value has really shifted towards the application layer and really rewarded rapid prototyping and rapid iteration. Because we understood the underlying technologies very well, we could move very, very fast. And markets have really rewarded that kind of agility. We are not going to be able to do that nearly as well for the next 10 or 20 years with these new technologies that are nascent today. So I would say that it's much more important to prepare than it is to adapt. And that was also true during the digital age, during the digital revolution. Google hasn't adapted very well, right? I mean, nobody talks about Google adapting to, you know, search engines or Apple adapting to smartphones. When Google tried to adapt to, because they invented those technologies, of course, when Google tried to adapt, for instance, to social networks, they weren't very successful. So I think if you take the attitude, well, it's not just about adapting, we need to look ahead a little bit and start preparing for a world that we're not capable of taking on now, and thinking about what we have to do to be able to operate in that world and understand it. But at the same time, there is still a lot of digital transformation based on technologies that we have today that still needs to be done. So I think you have to walk and chew gum at the same time. In my book, Mapping Innovation, I talked about how innovation is really a process of discovery, engineering, and transformation. And those things never happen in the same place at the same time with the same people. And the practice of managing innovation is largely the practice of managing handoffs through those three phases. So I think while every organization is going to be focused on one of those phases, whether it's discovery or engineering or transformation, I think that you really need to make sure that you're connecting to the other two phases.
So, Greg, thank you very much. Any practical advice that you would give to some of our listeners out there that if they want to tackle these grand challenges, what's the best practical thing for them to do?
Pretty much what I just said. I think that, you know, you need to be competitively responsive. You need to take care of your customers, your employees, your other stakeholders. But at the same time, you need to set aside at least some of your resources for exploration. Exploration is cheap. And as I mentioned before, if you don't explore, you won't discover. If you don't discover, you won't invent. And if you don't invent, you will be disrupted eventually, just like GE was.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much, Greg, for joining us on the podcast. Greg Sattell is the author of Mapping Innovation, and he has a wonderful blog, Digital Tonto. Greg, thank you very much.
To find out more information about the Exploiting Disruption in a Digital World program, go to www.london.edu/EDD.